Really? The city was abuzz that day with talk of an astral event, a comet storm, it was said. Even sensible people like Father and Thomas had been speaking about the apocalypse, but I knew my scandal with Burke was being discussed in parlors throughout Charleston with more fervor than the end of the world. The cabriolet was new enough, however, to be unfamiliar on the streets, and with its hood up and Mary's hat on, I didn't see how I could be recognized. With any luck, Mother would never know I'd broken my seclusion. Feeling anxious about Nina, I closed my eyes and imagined scooping her into my arms. Then there was a terrible jolt, and the carriage came to a shuddering stop on Cumming Street. The right wheel sunk into a mud hole. Good as coaxed the horse with the whip, then climbed down and tugged at the bridle and collar. The mare, known for her keen spirit of revenge, jerked her head and stepped backward, sinking the carriage further. I heard Goodis quietly curse. He went to the rear of the carriage and shoved, causing it to rock forward a little, but nothing more.
"Stay put where you is," he told me. "I gonna get us some help."
As he lumbered off, I surveyed the street. Despite the sogginess, there were ladies out strolling, men huddled in conclaves, Negro hawkers carrying troughs of shrimp and baskets of French coconut patties. I reached up nervously and touched the veil at my face, and it was at that moment I glimpsed Charlotte, walking toward Bull Street. She picked her way like a rope walker, moving along a narrow shelf of grass that ran beside a brick wall. She wore her red bandana low on her forehead and carried a basket bulging with cloth. Unaware of me or of the finely dressed woman with white skin who approached her on the same grassy ledge from the opposite direction. One of them would be forced to turn around and retrace her steps all the way back to where the brick wall began, or else yield way by stepping off into the muddy roadway. Face-offs of this sort played out on the street so regularly, a city ordinance had been passed requiring slaves to give deference. Had the slave been anyone other than Charlotte? Had it been Binna, Aunt Sister, Cindy, even Handful, I wouldn't have worried so much. But Charlotte. The two women stopped a few feet apart. The white woman lifted her parasol and tapped Charlotte's arm.
"Move along now. Off with you."
I didn't detect the slightest movement in Charlotte. She seemed to solidify as she stood there. The woman's umbrella thumped at her again. "Shoo, shoo." They exchanged words I didn't understand, their voices rising, turning into jagged antlers over their heads. I looked around frantically for Goodis. A man wearing a city guard uniform reined his horse in the middle of the street.
"Step aside, negress," he yelled.
He climbed from his horse, handing the reins to a slave boy who'd wandered up pulling a dray. Before the guard could reach the scene, Charlotte swung her basket. It moved in an arc, spilling what I realized were bonnets, then crashing against the woman's arm, knocking her sideways. The mud in the street was like pudding, viscous and pale brown as tapioca. And when the woman landed, perfectly seated, it made a little wave on either side of her. I leapt from the carriage and ran toward them with no thought of what I might do. The guardsman had seized Charlotte by the arms, assisted by another man whom he'd enlisted. They dragged her down the street while she spit and clawed. I chased them all the way to Bufane, where the men commandeered a wagon and forced her into the back, pushing her flat onto her stomach. The guardsman sat atop her. The driver snapped the reins, the horses jerked, and I could only stand there spattered with the pudding from the street. I swept back the veils on my hat and screamed her name. "Charlotte!" Her eyes found me. She did not make a sound, but held my gaze as the wagon rolled away.
Handful. Mama disappeared 2 days after we watched the stars fall. We were standing in the work yard near the back gate. She had the red scarf on her head and wore her good dress, the one dyed indigo. Her apron was pressed to a crisp. She'd oiled her lips and borrowed Benna's cowrie shell bracelets to dress up her wrists. In the sunlight, her skin had a gold luster, and her eyes shined like river rocks. That's how I see her now in my dreams, with the look she had then, almost happy. She pinned on her slave badge full of haste. She'd got permission to deliver her fresh-made bonnets, but I knew before the last one left the basket, she'd be obliging that man, Mr. Vesey. I said, "Be sure your badge is on good." Mama hated my pestering. "It's on there, handful. It ain't going nowhere." What about your pouch?" I couldn't see the bulge of it under her dress like usual. I kept both of our pouches fresh with scraps from our tree, and I meant for her to wear it, what with me going to all that trouble and her needing all the protection she could get. She fished it up from her bosom. Her fingers had faded smudges on them from the charcoal powder she used to trace designs on her bonnet. I wanted to say more to her. "Why are you wearing the good dress with all that mud out there? When are you planning on telling me about the baby? Now we got to buy freedom for the three of us?" But I shoved all this to the side for later. I lingered while Tomfrey unlocked the back gate and let her out. After she stepped through to the alley, she turned round and looked at me, then walked on off. After Mama left that day, I did everything usual. Cut sleeves and collars for the men's slaves to have work shirts, got busy on Mrs. Splash's, these squares of cloth you tack up behind the washstands, 'cause Lord forbid you get a drop of water on the wall. Each and every one had to be embroidered to the hilt. Middle of the afternoon, I went out to the privy. The sun had stayed put, and the sky was blue as cornflowers. Aunt Sister was in the kitchen house baking whole apples with custard poured around them, what's called a bird nest pudding, and that whole smell was in the air. I was on my way back inside, relishing the sweet air after being in the latrine, when the carriage came flying through the gate with Sarah and Nina, both of them looking scared to pieces. And look who was driving. Goodis. When it rolled to a stop, their feet hit the ground running. They passed me without a word and struck for the house. The little gray traveling cape I'd sewed Nina flapped behind her like a dove wing. Goodis gave me a long look of pity before he tugged the horse inside the stable. When the long shadows started, I sat on the porch steps to the kitchen house and watched the gate for Mama. Across the yard, Goodis held vigil with me in the stable door, whittling on a piece of wood. He knew something I didn't. The apple eggs were still in the air when Aunt Sister and Phoebe cleaned up and blew out the lamps. The dark came and no moon. Sarah found me hunched on the steps. She sat down close next to me. "A handful," she said. I wanted to be the one to tell you. It's Mama, ain't it? She got in a dispute with a white lady. The lady wanted her to give way on the street. She prodded your mother with an umbrella and... you know your mother, she wouldn't stand aside. She struck the lady. Sarah sighed into the dark and took hold of my hand. The city guard was there. They took her away. All this time I'd been waiting for her to say Mama was dead. Hope came back into me. "Where is she?" Sarah looked away from me, then... that's what I've been trying to discover. We don't know where she is. They were taking her to the guardhouse, but when Thomas went to pay the fine, he was told Charlotte had managed to wrestle free. Apparently she ran off. They said the guard chased her, but lost her in the alleys. They're out there looking for her now. All I could hear was breathing. Sarah, Goodis crossed the yard, the horses in the stable, the creatures in the brush, the white people on their feather beds, the slaves on their little pallets thin as wafers, everything breathing but me. Sarah walked with me to the basement. She said, "Would you like some warm tea? I can put a little brandy in it." I shook my head. She wanted to draw me to her for solace, I could tell, but she held back. Instead, she laid her hand gently on my arm and said, "She'll come back." I said those words all night long. I didn't know how to be in the world without her.
Sarah. Charlotte's disappearance brought a severe and terrible mercy. For not once throughout the harrowing weeks that followed Burke's betrayal was I uncertain which event was tragic and which was merely unfortunate. Someone, mother, father, perhaps Thomas, placed an ad in the Charleston Mercury. Disappeared, female slave. Mulatto. Wide space between upper front teeth. Occasional limp. Answers to the name of Charlotte. Wearing red scarf and dark blue dress. A seamstress of skill and value. Belongs to Judge John Grimke. Large reward for her return. The appeal brought no response. Each day I watched from the back window in my room as Handful walked a repetitive circuit in the workyard. Sometimes she walked the entirety of the morning. Never varying her path, she started at the back of the house, moved toward the kitchen house, past the laundry, cut over to the oak tree, where she touched the trunk as she passed, then back to the house by way of the stable and carriage house. Upon reaching the porch steps, she would simply begin again. It was a circumambulation of such precise, ritualistic grief. No one interfered. Even Mother left her to walk a rut of anguish into the yard. I didn't much mourn the loss of Burke or the demise of our wedding. I felt little heartbreak. Was that not strange? I did cry buckets, but mostly from the shame of it all. I didn't break my seclusion again. Instead, I took refuge in it. Almost daily I received notes of concern in flowery scripts. I was being prayed for by everyone imaginable. It was hoped my reputation wouldn't suffer too much. Did I know that Burke had vacated the city and was staying indefinitely with his uncle in Columbia? Wasn't it a shame that his mother had taken ill with apoplexy? How was my own mother bearing up? I was missed at tea, but my absence was commended. I shouldn't despair, for surely a young man would come forth who wouldn't be put off by my disgrace. I wrote rants and rebukes in my diary, then tore them out and burned them along with all the supercilious notes. Gradually, the lava in me subsided, and there remained only a young woman whose life course had been demolished. Unlike Handful, I had no notion what path to walk. 1 month after Charlotte's disappearance, a frigid wind brought down most of the leaves on the oak. Handful still walked obsessively each morning, but only a quick loop or so now. The week before, Mother had put a stop to her unremitting march and sent her back to her duties. The high social season, with its quota of gowns, awaited. All the sewing now fell to Handful. Charlotte was gone. No one believed she was coming back. I'd managed to stretch my 3 weeks of seclusion into four, but on this day, my reprieve ended. Mother had ordered me back to my duties as well, procuring a husband. She'd informed me that a rowboat traversing the Atlantic might eventually be rescued by a passing ship, but only if the rowboat bravely set out upon the water. This, her hapless metaphor of my marital prospects. My sister Mary arrived with similar encouragement. "Lift your chin, Sarah. Behave as if nothing has happened. Be gay and act assured. You'll find a husband, God willing." God willing. How strangely that strikes me now. On the evening my solitude ended, I shoved myself out into the public domain by attending a lecture at the Second Presbyterian Church, delivered by the Reverend Henry Colick, a famed preacher. Those were not the waters Mother had in mind. The Episcopal Church might pass for society, but certainly not the Presbyterians with their revivalism and shouts for repentance. But she didn't object. I was at least rowing, wasn't I? Sitting in a pew beside the devout friend who'd invited me, I scarcely listened at first. Words, sin, moral degradation, retribution, flitted in and out of my awareness, but at some point during that hour, I became morbidly engrossed. The Reverend's eyes found me. I can't explain it, nor did he look away as he spoke.
Are you not sick of the frivolous being you have become? Are you not mortified at your own folly, weary of the ballroom and its gilded toys? Will you not give up the vanities and gaieties of this life for the sake of your soul?
I felt utterly spoken to, and in the most direct and supernatural way. How could he know what lay inside me? How did he know what I was only that moment able to see myself?
God calls you,
he bellowed.
God, your beloved, begs you to answer.
The words ravished me. They seemed to break down some great artifice. I sat on the pew quietly shaken, while Reverend Colic looked at me now without focus or interest, and perhaps it had been so all along, but it didn't matter. He'd been God's mouthpiece. He'd delivered me to the precipice where one's only choice was between paralysis or abandon. With the Reverend praying a long, earnest prayer for our souls, I took my leap. I vowed I would not return to society. I would not marry. I would never marry. Let them say what they would. I would give myself to God. 2 weeks later, on my 20th birthday, I entered the drawing room, where the family had gathered to offer me well wishes, accompanied by Nina, who clung to my hand. Seeing that I'd chosen to wear one of my simpler dresses and no jewelry, Mary smiled at me sadly as if I wore the costume of a nun. I gathered Mother had confided my religious conversion to my sisters, perhaps to my father and brothers as well. Aunt Sister had baked my favored dessert, a two-tiered election cake, filled with currants and sugar. Such cakes were molded on a board with yeast and left to rise, if they so elected, and this one had done so with majesty. Nina pranced about it impatiently until Mother signaled Aunt Sister to cut the slices. Father was seated with my brothers, who were engaged in a debate of some sort. Edging to the fringes, I determined that Thomas had evoked their wrath by promoting a program known as colonization. From what I could gather, the term had little to do with the British occupation of the last century and everything to do with the slaves. What's this concept? I asked, and they turned to me as if a housefly had pried through a slat in the shutters and was buzzing wantonly about.
It's a new and advanced idea, Thomas answered. Despite what any of you believe, it will soon expand into a national movement. Mark my words.
But what is it? I said.
It proposes we free the slaves and send them back to Africa.
Nothing had prepared me for so radical a scheme.
Why, that's preposterous.
My reaction took them by surprise. Even Henry and Charles, now 13 and 12, gaped at me.
Christ preserve us, said John. Sarah is against it.
He assumed I'd outgrown my rebellions and become like the rest of them, a guardian of slavery. I couldn't fault him for it. When was the last time any of them had heard me speak out against the peculiar institution? I'd been wandering about in the enchantments of romance, afflicted with the worst female curse on earth, the need to mold myself to expectations. John was laughing. A fire raged on the grate, and Father's face was bright and sweating. He wiped at it and joined the mirth.
"Yes, I am against colonization," I began.
There was no falter now in my throat. I forced myself to keep on.
"I'm against it, but not for the reason you think. We should free the slaves, but they should remain here, as equals."
An odd intermezzo ensued, during which no one spoke. There'd been mounting talk from certain clergy and pious women about treating slaves with Christian sympathy, and now and then some rare soul would speak of freeing the slaves altogether. But equality? Ludicrous! By law, a slave was 3/5 of a person. It came to me that what I'd just suggested would seem paramount to proclaiming vegetables equal to animals, animals equal to humans, women equal to men, men equal to angels. I was upending the order of creation. Strangest of all, it was the first time thoughts of equality had entered my head, and I could only attribute it to God, with whom I'd lately taken up, and who was proving to be more insurrectionary than law-abiding.
"My goodness, did you learn this from the Presbyterians?" Father asked. "Are they saying slaves should live among us as equals?"
The question was sarcastic, meant for my brothers and for the moment itself. Yet I answered him.
"No, Father, I'm saying it."
As I spoke, a rush of pictures spilled through my mind, all of them handful. She was tiny, wearing the lavender bow on her neck. She was filling the house with smoke. She was learning to read. She was sipping tea on the roof. I saw her taking her lash, wrapping the oak with stolen thread, bathing in the copper tub, sewing works of pure art, walking bereaved circles. I saw everything as it was.
Handful. Mama was gone, sure as I'm sitting here, and I couldn't do a thing but walk the yard trying to siphon my sorrow. The sorry truth is, you can walk your feet to blisters, walk till kingdom come, and you never will outpace your grief. Come December, I stopped all that. I halted in my track by the woodpile where we used to feed the little owl way back then, and I said out loud, "Damn you for saving yourself! How come you left me with nothing but to love you and hate you, and that's gonna kill me, and you know it is?" Then I turned round, went back to the cellar room, and picked up the sewing. Don't think she wasn't in every stitch I worked. She was in the wind, and the rain, and the creaking from the rocker. She sat on the wall with the birds and stared at me. When darkness fell, she fell with it. One day, before they started the days of Christmas in the house, I looked at the wood trunk on the floor, shoved behind Mama's gunny sack. I said, "Now where'd you go and put the key?" I had got where I talked to her all the time. Like I would say, I didn't hear her talk back, so I hadn't lost my sanities. I turned the room upside down and the key was nowhere. It could have been in her pocket when she went missing. We had an axe in the yard shed, but I hated to chop the trunk apart. I said, "If I was you, where would I hide the key that locked up the only precious things I had?" I stood there a while. Then I lifted my eyes to the ceiling, to the quilt frame. The wheels on the pulley were fresh with oil. They didn't make a peep when I brought down the frame. Sure enough, the key was laying in the groove along one of the boards. Inside the trunk was a fat bundle wrapped in muslin. I peeled back the folds and you could smell Mama, that salty smell. I had to take a minute to cry. I held her quilt squares against me, thinking how she said they were the meat on her bones. There were 10 good-sized squares. I spread them out across the frame. The colors she'd used outdid God and the rainbow. Reds, purples, oranges, pinks, yellows, blacks, and browns. They hit my ears more than my eyes. They sounded like she was laughing and crying in the same breath. It was the finest work ever to come from Mama's hands. The first square showed her Mama standing small, holding her Mama and Daddy's hands, and the stars falling around them. That was the night my granny Mama got sold away, the night the story started. The rest was a hodgepodge. Some squares I could figure, some I couldn't. There was a woman hoeing in the fields. I guessed her to be my granny Mama, too, wearing a red headscarf and a baby. My Mama was laying in the growing plants. Slave people were flying in the air over their heads, disappearing behind the sun. Next one was a little girl sitting on a three-leg stool, appliquing a quilt, red with black triangles, some of the triangles spilling on the floor. I said, "I guess that's you, but it could be me." Fourth one had a spirit tree on it, with red thread on the trunk, and the branches were filled with vultures. Mama had sewed a woman and baby boy on the ground. You could tell it was a boy from his privates. I figured they were my granny Mama when she died and her boy that didn't make it. Both were dead and picked bloody. I had to walk out in the cold air after that one. You come from your Mama, you sleep in the bed with her till you're near 20 years grown, and you still don't know what haunches in the dark corners of her. I came back inside and studied the next one. It had a man in the field. He had a brown hat on, and the sky was full of eyes sitting in the clouds. Big yellow eyes and red rain falling from the lids. "That man is my daddy, Shaney," I said to myself. One after that was Mama and a baby girl stretched on the quilt frame. I knew that girl was me, and our bodies were cut in pieces, bright patches that needed piecing back. It made my head sick and dizzy to look at it. Another square was Mama sewing a wild purple dress covered with moons and stars, only she was doing it in a mouse hole, the walls bent over her. Going picture to picture felt like I was turning pages in a book she left behind, one that held her last words. Somewhere along the way, I stopped feeling anything. Like when you lay on your arm wrong and you wake up and it's pins and needles. I started looking at the appliques that had taken Mama 2 years to sew like they didn't have any belonging to me, 'cause that was the only way I could bear to see them. I let them float by like panes of light. Here was Mama with her leg hitched up behind her with a strap standing in the yard getting the one-legged punishment. Here was another spirit tree, same like the other one, but it was ours. And it didn't have vultures, only green leaves and a girl underneath with a book and a whip coming down to strike her. Last square was a man, a bull of a man with a carpenter apron on, Mr. Denmark Vesey. And next to him, she'd stitched four numbers big as he was, 1884. I didn't have a notion what that meant. I went straight to stitching, hell with misses in her gowns. All that day and far in the night, I pieced Mama's squares together with the tiny stitches you can't barely see. I sewed on the lining and filled the quilt with the best padding we saved and the whole collection of our feathers. Then I took shears to my hair and cut every bit of it off my head, down to a scalp of fuzz. I loosed the cut hair all through the stuffing. That's when I remembered about the money. 8 years saving. I went over and looked down in the trunk, and it was empty as air. $400. Gone, same as Mama. And I'd run out of places to look. I couldn't draw a breath. Next day, after I'd slept a little, I sewed the layers of the quilt together with a tacking stitch. Then I wrapped the finished quilt round me like a glory cloak. I wore it out into the yard where Aunt Sister was bundled up chopping cane sugar, and she said, "Girl, what you got on you? What'd you do to your head?" I didn't say nothing. I walked back to the tree with my breath trailing clouds, and I wrapped new thread round the trunk. Then the noise came into the sky. The crows were flying over and smoke from the chimneys rising to meet them. "There you go," I said. "There you go." Part 3, October 1818 to November 1820. Handful. Some days I'd be coming down East Bay and catch sight of a woman with cinnamon skin slipping round a corner, a snatch of red scarf on her head, and I'd say, "There you are again." I was 25 years old and still talking to her. Every October, on the anniversary day of Mama gone missing, us slaves sat in the kitchen house and reminisced on her. I hated to see that day come dragging round. On the 6-year mark, Benna patted my leg and said, "Yo, Mama gone, but we still here. The sky ain't falling yet." No, but every year one more slat got knocked out from under it. That evening, they dredged up stories on Mama that went on past supper, stealing the bolt of green cloth, hoodwinking Mrs. with her limp, wrangling the cellar room, getting herself hired out, that whole Jesus act she did. Tomfrey told about the time Mrs. had him search the premise and Mama was nowhere on it, how we slipped her in the front door to the roof, then trumped up that story about her falling asleep there. Same old tales. Same laughing and slapping. Now that she was gone, they loved her a lot better. "You sure do have her eyes," Goodis said, looking at me moon-faced like he always did. I did have her eyes, but the rest of me had come from my daddy. Mama said he was an undersized man and blacker than the backside of the moon. On my sake, they left out the stories of her pain and sorrow. Nothing about what might have happened to her. Every one of them, even Goodis, believed she'd run and was living the high life of freedom somewhere. I could more easy believe she'd been on the roof all this time sleeping. Outside, the day was fading off. Tomfrey said it was time to light the lamps in the house, but nobody moved. And I felt the ache for them to know the real woman Mama was. Not just the cunning one, but the one smelted from iron, the one who paced the nights and prayed to my granny mama. Mama had yearned more in a day than they felt in a year. She'd worked herself to the bone and courted danger, searching for something better. I wanted them to know that woman. That was the one who wouldn't leave me. I said, "She didn't run off. I can't help what you think, but she didn't run." They just sat there and looked at me. You could see the little wheels turning in their heads. The poor misled girl, the poor misled girl. Tomfrey spoke up, said, "Handful, think now. If she didn't run off, she got to be dead. Which one you want us to believe?" No one had put it to me that straight before. Mama's story quilt had slaves flying through the sky and slaves laying dead on the ground. But in my way of reckoning, Mama was lost somewhere between the two, between fly away and dead and gone. Which one? The air was stiff as starch. "Not neither one," I told him and got up from there and left. In my room, I lay down on the bed on top of the story quilt and stared at the quilt frame still nailed to the ceiling. I never lowered it anymore, but I slept under Mama's stories every night except summers and the heat of autumn. And I knew them front, back, and sideways. Mama had sewed where she came from, who she was, what she loved, the things she'd suffered, and the things she hoped. She'd found a way to tell it. After a while, I heard footsteps overhead. Tomfrey, Cindy, Benna up there lighting lamps. I didn't have to worry with Sarah's lamp anymore. I just had sewing duties now. Some time ago, Sarah had given me back to Mrs., official on paper. She said she didn't want part in owning a human person. She'd come special to my room to tell me. So nerve-wracked, She couldn't hardly get the words up. I would have freed you if I could, but there's a law. It doesn't allow owners to easily free slaves anymore. Otherwise, I would have. You know that, don't you? After that, it was plain as the freckles on her face. The only way I was getting away from Mrs. was drop dead, get sold, or find the hid place Mama had gone. Some days I mooned over the money Mama'd saved. It never had turned up. If I could find that fortune, I could try and buy my freedom from Mrs. like we'd planned on. Least I'd have a chance. A horse piss of a chance, but it would be enough to keep me going. 6 years gone. I rolled over on the bed, my face to the window. I said, Mama, what happened to you? When the new year came round, I was in the market getting what Aunt Sister needed when I overheard the slave who cleaned the butcher stall talking about the African church. This slave's name was Jesse, a good, kind man. He used to take the leftover pig bladders and fill them with water for the children to have a balloon. I didn't usually pay him any mind. He was always wagging his tongue, putting praise the Lord at the end of every sentence. But this day, I don't know why it was, I went over there to hear what he was saying. Aunt Sister had told me to hurry back, that it looked like sleet coming, but I stood there with the raw smell hanging in the air while he talked about the church. I found out the proper name was African Methodist Episcopal Church, and it was just for coloreds, slaves, and free blacks together, and it was meeting in an empty hearse house near the black burial ground. Said the place was packed to the rafters every night. A slave man next to me, wearing some worn-out-looking livery, said, "Since when is this city so full trusting to let slaves run their own church?" Everybody laughed at that, like the joke was on Charleston. Jesse said, "Well, ain't that the truth, praise the Lord. There's a man at the church who's always talking about Moses leading the slaves from Egypt, praise the Lord. He said Charleston is Egypt all over again, praise the Lord." My scalp pricked. I said, "What's the man's name?" Jesse said, "Denmark Vesey." For years, I'd refused to think of Mr. Vesey, how Mama had sewed him on the last square of her story quilt. I didn't like the man being on it, didn't like the man, period. I never thought he knew anything about what happened to her. Why would he? But standing there, a bell rang in my head and told me it was worth a try. Maybe then I could put Mama to rest. That's when I decided to get religion. First chance I got, I told Sarah I was burdened down with the need for deliverance and God was calling me to the African church. I dabbed at my eyes a little. I was cut straight from Mama's cloth. Next day, Mrs. called me to her room. She was sitting by the window with her Bible laid open. "It has come to my attention you wish to join a new church that has been established in the city for your kind. Sarah informs me you want to attend nightly meetings. I'll allow you to go twice a week in the evenings and on Sunday, as long as it doesn't interfere with your work or cause problems of any sort. Sarah will prepare your pass." She looked at me through her little glasses. She said, "See to it you don't squander the favor I'm granting you." "Yes, sir." For measure, I added, "Praise the Lord."
Sarah. I couldn't imagine why Nina and I had been summoned to the first floor drawing room. That was never a good thing. We entered to find the very corpulent Reverend Gadsden seated on the yellow silk settee. And beside him, Mother, squeezed way over to one side, gripping her cane as if she might bore it into the floor. Glancing at Nina, who at 14 was taller than I was, I noticed her eyes flash beneath their thick, dark lashes. She gave her chin a tiny, defiant yank upward, and for a moment I felt a passing bit of pity for the Reverend.
Close the door behind you,
Mother said. Down the passageway, Father was in his room, too ill now to work. Dr. Geddings had ordered quiet, and for weeks the slaves had padded about, speaking in whispers, careful not to rattle a tray for fear of their lives. When one's physician prescribes quiet as a remedy, along with a syrup made from horseradish root, he has clearly given up. I took my seat on the twin settee beside Nina, facing the pair of them. The accusation against me would be failing as Nina's godmother, as usual. This past Sunday, my sister had refused confirmation into St. Philip's Church, and it wasn't even that as much as the way she'd done it. She'd made a pageant of it. When the other youths left their chairs on the dais and went to the altar rail for the bishop to lay his hands on their sweet heads, Nina remained pointedly in her seat. Our entire family was there, except for Father, and I watched with a confused mix of embarrassment and pride as she sat with her arms crossed, her dark hair gleaming around her shoulders, and a tiny circle of red blazing on each of her cheeks. The bishop walked over and spoke to her, and she shook her head. Mother went stiff as a piece of wrought iron on the pew beside me, and I felt the air in the church clotting around our heads. There was more coaxing by the bishop, more obstinacy by Nina, until he gave up and continued the service. I'd had no inkling what she planned, though perhaps I should have. This was Nina, after all. She was full of fiery opinions and mutinous acts. Last winter, she'd scandalized her classroom by taking off her shoes because the slave boy, who cleaned the slate boards, was barefooted. I'd lost count of the letters of apology Mother had ordered her to write. Rather than submit, she would sit before the blank paper for days until Mother relented. On her 11th birthday, Nina had refused her human present with such vehemence, Mother had given up, out of sheer weariness. Even if I'd tried to prevent Nina's display at church that day, she would have pointed out that I, too, had spurned the Anglicans. Well, I had, but I'd done so to embrace the Presbyterians, whereas Nina would have spurned the Presbyterians, too, given half a chance. She hated them for what she called their gall and wormwood. If there was a wedge between my sister and me, it was religion. Over the last several years, it seemed my entire life had been possessed of swings between asceticism and indulgence. I'd banished society in the aftermath of Burke Williams, yes, but I'd been a chronic backslider, succumbing every season to some party or ball, which had left me empty and sickened, which had then sent me crawling back to God. Nina had often found me on my knees, weeping as I prayed, begging forgiveness, engaged in one of my excruciating bouts of self-contempt. "Why must you be like this?" she would shout. Why indeed? Mr. Williams had been shaken from the lap of Charleston like a soiled napkin. He was married now to his cousin, keeping shop in his uncle's dry goods store in Columbia. I'd put him behind me long ago, but I hadn't been able to make peace with living here in this house till the end of my days. I had Nina, but not for much longer. As charismatic and beautiful as she was, she would be wooed by a dozen men and leave me here with Mother. It was the ubiquitous truth at the center of everything, and it had driven me to my backsliding. But there could be no more of that. At 26 I would be too old for the coming season. It was truly over, and I felt lost and miserable, galled and wormwooded, and there was nothing to be done about it. Here in the drawing room, Reverend Gadsden looked reluctant and uncomfortable. He kept pursing and unpursing his lips. Nina sat erect beside me, as if to say, "All right, let the castigation begin." But under the cover of our skirts, she reached for my hand.
"I'm here today because your mother asked me to reason with you. You gave us all a shock yesterday. It's a grave thing to reject the church and her sacraments and salvation."
He went on with his jabber,
while Nina's hand sweated into mine. She saw my private agonies, but I saw hers, too. There was a place inside of her where it had all broken. The screams she'd heard coming from the workhouse still inhabited her, and she would wake some nights, shouting into the dark. She put up an invincible show, but underneath I knew her to be bruised and vulnerable. After Mother's scathing reprimands, she would vanish into her room for hours, emerging with her eyes bloodshot from weeping. The Reverend's kind but tedious speech had been floating in and out of my awareness.
"I must point out," I heard him say, "that you are placing your soul in jeopardy."
Nina spoke for the first time. "Pardon me, Reverend Sir, but the threat of hell will not move me."
Mother sank her eyes closed. "Oh, Angelina, for the love of God."
Nina had used the word hell. Even I was a little shocked by it. The rector sat back with resignation. He was done. Naturally, Mother was not.
"Your father lies gravely ill. Surely you know it's his wish that you be confirmed into the church. It could well be his last wish. Would you deny him that?"
Nina squeezed my hand, struggling to hold on to herself.
Should she deny her conscience or her father?" I said.
Mother drew back as if I had slapped her.
"Are you going to sit there and encourage your sister's disobedience?"
"I'm encouraging her to be true to her own scruples."
"Her scruples?"
The skin at Mother's neck splotched like beetroot. She turned to the Reverend.
"As you see, Angelina is completely under Sarah's sway. What Sarah thinks, Angelina thinks. What Sarah scruples, she scruples. It's my own fault. I chose Sarah to be her godmother, and to this day, she leads the child astray."
"Mother!" Nina exclaimed.
"I think for myself."
Mother shifted her calm, pitiless gaze from the Reverend to Nina, and uttered the question that would always lie between us.
"Just so I'm not confused, when you said Mother just now, were you referring to me or to Sarah?"
The rector squirmed on the settee and reached for his hat, but Mother continued.
"As I was saying, Reverend, I'm at a loss of how to undo the damage. As long as the two of them are under the same roof, there's small hope for Angelina."
As she escorted the Reverend to the door, rain broke loose outside. I felt Nina slump slightly against me, and I pulled her to her feet, and we slipped behind them up the stairs. In my room, I turned back the bedsheet and Nina lay down. Her face seemed stark and strange against the linen pillow. Rain was darkening the window, and she stared at it with her eyes gleaming, her back rising and falling beneath my hand.
"Do you think Mother will send me away?" she asked. "I won't allow it," I told her, though I had no idea how to stop such a thing if Mother took it in her head to banish my sister. A rebellious girl could easily be sent off to a boarding school, or deported to our uncle's plantation in North Carolina.
Handful. "Didn't my lord deliver Daniel?" Denmark Vesey shouted. The whole church answered, "Now he's coming for me." Must have been 200 of us packed in there. I was sitting in the back, in the usual spot. Folks had started leaving it free for me, saying, "That's Handful's place." 4 months, I'd been sitting there and hadn't learned a thing about Mama, but I knew more than Mrs. about the people God had delivered. Abraham, Moses, Samson, Peter, Paul. Mr. Vesey went down the list, chanting their names. Everybody was on their feet clapping and waving in the air, shouting, "Now he's coming for me." and I was smack dab in the middle of them, doing the little hopping dance I used to do in the alcove when I was a girl singing to the water. Our reverend was a free black man named Morris Brown, and he said when we got worked up like this, it was the Holy Ghost that had got into us. Mr. Vesey, who was one of his four main helpers, said it wasn't the Holy Ghost, it was hope. Whatever it was, it could burn a hole in your chest. The heat from the church was awful. While we shouted, sweat drenched our faces and clothes, and some of the men got up and opened all the windows. The fresh air flowed in and the shouting flowed out. When Mr. Vesey ran out of people in the Bible for God to deliver, he went along the benches calling names. Let my Lord deliver Rolla. Let my Lord deliver Nancy. Let my Lord deliver Ned. If you called your name, you felt like it would fly straight to heaven and hit God between the eyes. Reverend Brown said, be careful. Heaven would be whatever you picture it. His picture was Africa before the slaving. All the food and freedom you wanted and not a white person to blight it. If Mama was dead, she would have a big, fine house somewhere and missus for her maid. Mr. Vesey, though, he didn't like any kind of talk about heaven. He said that was the coward's way, pining for life in the hereafter, acting like this one didn't mean a thing. I had to side with him on that. Even when I was singing and hopping like this, part of me stayed small and quiet, noticing everything he said and did. I was the bird watching the cat circle the tree. Mr. Vesey had white woolly nubs in his hair now, but beside that, he looked like before. Wore the same scowl, had the same knife blades in his eyes. His arms were still thick and his chest big as a rain barrel. I hadn't mustered the nerve to talk to him. People feared Denmark Vesey. I started telling myself the joke was on me. Maybe I'd come to the African church for the Lord after all. What I think I could learn about Mama anyway. Nobody heard the horses outside. Mr. Vesey had a new chant going. Joshua fought the Battle of Jericho, and the walls came tumbling down. Gullah Jack, his right-hand man, was beating a drum, and we were stomping the floor. Jericho! Jericho! Then the doors busted open, and Gullah Jack's hand stopped pounding, and the song died away. We looked round, confused. While the city guards spread along the walls and in the aisle, one at every window, four barring the door. The head guard marched down front with a paper in one hand and a musket gun in the other. Denmark Vesey said with his booming voice, what's the meaning of this? This is the house of the Lord. You have no business here. The guard looked like he couldn't believe his luck. He took the butt of the gun and rammed it in Mr. Vesey's face. A minute ago, he'd been shouting Jericho, and now he was on the floor with a shirt full of blood. People started screaming. One of the guards fired into the rafters, sending wood crumbs and smoke swirling down. The inside of my ears pounded, and when the head man read the warrant, he sounded like he was at the bottom of a dry well. He said the neighbors round the church found us a nuisance. We were charged with disorderly conduct. He stuffed the paper in his pocket. You'll be removed to the guardhouse and sentenced in the morning with due and proper punishment. A sob drifted from a woman on the far side, and the place came alive with fear and murmuring. We knew about the guardhouse. It was where they held the lawbreakers, black and white, till they figured out what to do with them. The white ones stayed till their hearings, and the black ones till their owners paid the fine. You just prayed to God you didn't have a stingy master, 'cause if you refused to pay, you went to the workhouse to work off the debt. Outside, the moon looked weak in the sky. They gathered us in four herds and marched us down the street. A slave sang, didn't my Lord deliver Daniel? And a guard told him to hush up. It was quiet from then on except for the clopping horses and a little baby tied on its mother's back that whimpered like a kitten. I craned my neck for Mr. Vesey, but he wasn't anywhere to see. Then I noticed the dark, wet spatter drops on the ground, and I knew he was on up ahead. We spent the night on the floor in a room filled with jail cells, men and women crammed in together, all of us having to pee in the same bucket in the corner. One woman coughed half through the night, and two men got in a shove fight. But mostly we sat in the dark and stared with flat eyes and dozed in and out. One time, I came awake hearing that same little baby mewing. At first light, a guard with hair scruffing his shoulders brought a pail of water with a dipper, and we took turns drinking while our stomachs rumbled for food. After that, we were left to wonder what was coming. One man in our cell had been picked up by the guard 6 times, and he told us the facts and figures. The fine was $5, and if your master didn't pay, you got 12 lashes at the workhouse, or worse, you got the treadmill. I didn't know what the treadmill was, and he didn't say, just told us to beg for the whip. Then he lifted his shirt, and his back was grooved like the hide of an alligator. The sight brought bile to my throat. My master never pay, he said. The morning stretched out, and we waited, and then waited some more. All I could think about was the man's back, where they put Mr. VC, how his bashed face was holding up. Heat cooked the air, and the smell turned sour, and the baby started bawling again. Somebody said, "Why don't you feed the child?" "I can't raise no milk," its mama said. And another woman with stains on her dress front said, "Here, give me the baby. Mine's back home, and all this milk with nobody to suck it." She pulled out her brown bosom, clear milk leaking from the nipple, and the baby latched on. When the long-haired guard came back, he said, "Listen for your name. If I call it out, you're free to leave and go home to whatever awaits you." We all got to our feet. I said to myself, never has been a Grimke slave sent to the workhouse, never has. Seth Ball, Ben Pringle, Tinny Alston, Jane Bruton, Apollo Rutledge. He read the names till it was just me and the scarred man and a mama with a baby and a handful of others. "If you're still here," he said, "your owner has decided the workhouse will put you in a wholesome frame of mind." A man said, "I'm a free black. I don't have an owner." "If you've got the papers to say that, then you can pay the fine yourself," the guard told him. "If you can't pay it on the spot, then you're going to the workhouse with the rest." I felt genuine confused. I said, Mister, you left off my name. It's Hetty. Hetty Grimke?" He answered me with a thud of the door. The treadmill was chomping and grinding its teeth. You could hear it before you got in the room. The workhouse man led 12 of us to the upper gallery, poking us along with a stick. Denmark Vesey came behind me with the side of his face swollen so bad his eye was shut. He was the only one of us with shackles on his hands and feet. He took shuffle steps, and the chain dragged and rattled. When he tripped on the stairs, I said over my shoulder, "Be careful now." Then I whispered, "How come you didn't pay the fine? Ain't you supposed to have money?" "Whatever they do to the least of them, they do it onto me," he said. I thought to myself, Mr. Vesey fancies himself like Jesus carrying the cross, and that's probably because he doesn't have $5 on him for the fine. Knowing him, though, he could have been throwing his lot with the rest of us. The man was big-headed and proud, but he had a heart. When we got to the gallery and looked over the rail at the torment waiting for us, we just folded up and sat down on the floor. One of the overseers fastened Mr. Vesey's chain to an iron ring and told us to watch the wheel careful so we'd know what to do. The mama with the baby on her back said to him, "Who gonna watch my baby while I down there?" He said, "You think we got people to tend to your baby?" I had to turn from her. The way her head dropped, the baby looking wide-eyed over her shoulder. The treadmill was a spinning drum,